We get used to the idea of money being an abstraction. I mean, few of us keep money under the bed, fearful of putting it in banks or other places for safekeeping. So we're accustomed to the idea of money being available, just not physically there. Bitcoin and other cybercurrencies challenge our comfort level with money as an abstraction because it's money you can never touch. There is no physical representation of it. And that might add to the ongoing confusion about how cryptocurrencies have and store value. Stephen McKeon is a finance professor at the University of Oregon. He knows all about crypto assets, not just currency. And he's our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio, our joint project with the U of O. Dr. McKeon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
One of the things I find when we talk about Bitcoin, blockchain, Ethereum, all of the things involved out there, it's hard to find a good analogy for blockchain or cryptocurrencies. Can you give it a shot?
Sure. So I guess the first thing I would say is that Bitcoin and blockchain are not synonymous.
Right.
Those are two different concepts. The way you could think about blockchain is that it's a technology. And it's a technology that allows us to organize and store and confirm data. And you could think of Bitcoin as an implementation, in fact, the first implementation of that technology. And so that's the first distinction I usually make. When you compare something like Bitcoin and Ethereum, you could think of Bitcoin as an asset that you can send back and forth between sort of peer-to-peer, whereas Ethereum, you get sort of an extra level of complexity, which is that you can add a conditional statement. So you could say, send the value, if we get a tracking for a package that's been shipped, or send the value if this, that, or the other thing. And so allowing us to put those smart contracts on and add an extra layer of essentially a conditional statement is one of the things that differentiates it from Bitcoin.
Is one of the attractions of Bitcoin then and cryptocurrencies generally that there really aren't middle people in the sense of you're having to use a bank or something like that?
Yes. So a common phrase that people use is decentralization. And I guess, when I start to explain these concepts to people, I usually draw an analogy to the way we process payments in the banking system. Because ultimately, Bitcoin or any of these cryptocurrencies, they boil down to the idea that it's a ledger, and it's a ledger that helps us, establish a consensus about what the facts are about who owns a particular asset.
So, but it's a distributed ledger. Nobody has hold of the ledger just in their own domain.
That's right. So if you think of the way your bank keeps track of how much money you have in your account, that's a centralized ledger. So the bank is maintaining that ledger. Whereas in Bitcoin, it's a decentralized ledger, so we have a crowd of computers, we call them nodes and miners, that are keeping track of that ledger as opposed to a centralized entity.
Is there a certain, I'm still struggling with the term to come up with, is there a certain cuteness value that cryptocurrencies are hip when old money is not?
It's certainly the case that younger generations are more comfortable with these digital assets. They've sort of grown up in a native digital environment. So I guess they're hip in that sense. But there actually are, there are similarities. Like when you think about how a bank processes a payment, right? So, I'm at one bank, you're at a different bank, you write me a check, I deposit it. How does the money actually end up in my account? Well, when the check is presented, they need to verify two things. They need to verify that, in fact, you wrote it, and then they need to verify that you have sufficient funds in your accounts. So we call those two things authentication. That's like saying, did the payment truly come from the account holder? And authorization, which is like saying, does the account have enough money in it to process the payment? Ultimately, what the Bitcoin software is doing boils down to those same two things, authentication and authorization. So in that way, it actually is relatively similar to banks. The difference is that rather than a single entity performing those functions, we have a crowd performing those functions.
Bitcoin and other cyber currencies, and for that matter, other versions of cyber assets, are the domain of Stephen McKeon, a finance professor at the University of Oregon, our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. Your questions and comments welcome if you're still struggling to understand Bitcoin and the blockchain that enables Bitcoin and all the other cryptocurrencies. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So what insulates, Stephen, cryptocurrencies from boom and bust cycles like we have in regular currency?
So in that sense, you know, they do go through boom and bust cycles, of course. As we've seen, there's been a large drawdown in value since, say, the beginning of the year. But that same thing does happen in fiat currencies as well. So we're seeing it right now in Turkey. We've seen currencies fail in places like Zimbabwe. I think the way to look at Bitcoin is that it's really a function of expectations, right? And to the degree that, you know, expectations change, that alters demand for the asset, and so it moves the price.
So what would stop a crash? I mean, and do you have anybody? You know, there's no central bank, obviously. There's no Federal Reserve with any of these cryptocurrencies. So, is it possible there could be a crisis at some point after the world decides to shift to cryptocurrencies?
So, just like with many of these things, so just to be clear, just because you have a central bank doesn't necessarily prevent a crash.
True.
Right? So Turkey has a central bank. We're seeing that currency crash. Venezuela has a central bank. We're seeing that currency crash. So those things are not unique necessarily to crypto, but all of these things are just functions of belief. So to the extent that everyone decided, you know, we don't value this asset anymore, you would see the value crash. To the extent that people believe that it still has value, then you're going to see the price reflect that. So in that sense, it's not much different than gold, right? So why does gold have value? It's because we all as a society have collectively decided that it has a certain amount of value, and the markets are the way we express that opinion. So Bitcoin is much the same in that sense.
And I noticed there was some work you've done on first generation exchanges and second generation exchanges in Bitcoin. What is that about?
So you could think of exchanges falling into a couple different categories. So you have so-called centralized exchanges, and that would be an example might be Coinbase. And that is, you know, as the name implies, meaning centralized, it's operated by a single company, and they take custody of your assets and trade, much like it would work on the New York Stock Exchange or something like this. The new generation of exchanges are so-called decentralized exchanges. And what these do is they facilitate trade, but they don't ever take custody of your assets. So it's truly peer-to-peer, and the software is just sort of matching up buyers and sellers without ever holding the assets themselves.
So we have a very obvious question here from Greg in Ashland, who dropped it off. He didn't stay on the line. He wants to know how Bitcoin mining works. So you actually can, the original idea of Bitcoin, as I understand it, was there would just be a limited number of Bitcoins, but that has now been added to by the process of mining, which is computer processors burning up a lot of electricity, it sounds like.
Yeah, so the way I usually draw a mental model for people around mining is that it's akin to accountants, which is not the first thing you think of when you hear the word mining, right? You think maybe of people with, pickaxes and helmets down in a cave somewhere. But really, if you think about, remember earlier I mentioned that what this network of computers is doing is really processing transactions. We need to pay them for that service, right? So they're not going to do it for free. They do it because there's an economic incentive. And so as all these payments get processed and validated, you have lots of computers that are competing to be the accountant for that block, is one way to phrase it. And so what mining is they are validating a block of transactions, and there's a lot of technical complexity I won't get into, but basically they're competing. They're trying to solve a puzzle, and if they solve this puzzle, they get to be the accountant. And the reward is that a little bit of new Bitcoin is created as a payment to them for that service. And so that's essentially what mining is. It's computers that are doing the validation and the processing of all these transactions, and the new Bitcoin is created as a payment for that service. And so it subsidizes in the sense that we don't have to pay perhaps quite as much transaction fee because the network is creating a little bit of new Bitcoin every single block to pay the computers for that service.
And the Bitcoin goes to the winner of the race to complete the transaction?
So the transactions are like you sending 5 Bitcoin to me or me sending 2 Bitcoin to my brother. So all these messages get sent to the network. And then what the miners are doing is they're trying to collect those together and validate them and then post them. So sort of that would become a new block in the chain. And what they're doing is they're all competing to do this, right? So that this is what sort of burns up all the energy, is that they all want to be the one to find the next block, to sort of be the accountant for the next set of transactions. And so they're all competing to solve a very complicated math problem, and whoever solves that problem first gets to be the miner for that block. And so that's where a lot of the resource intensity comes in, is that you have lots and lots and lots of computers all trying to solve the same math problem. It's sort of like entering a lottery, right? So they all get a bunch of tickets, and then somebody gets chosen. It's effectively random. And then they get to be the accountant or the miner for that block of transactions.
Stephen McKeon is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a finance professor at the University of Oregon who studies crypto assets, security issuance, private equity, and mergers and acquisitions. We're talking about the Bitcoin, blockchain, cryptocurrencies, crypto assets of all kinds. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 with your questions and comments. 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Is the mining technique, is that unique to Bitcoin, or is this something that other cybercurrencies do as well?
So Bitcoin uses a process called proof of work, and that's where the miners come in. So they're doing the work. Most cryptocurrencies are functioning on that consensus system. There are alternatives. There's something called proof of stake and proof of, dynamic proof of stake and delegated proof of stake. There's other systems that are out there, but Bitcoin and Ethereum and many of the ones you've heard of are currently using proof of work, that it may not be that way forever.
So what ultimately delivers value here? What do people see in Bitcoin or Ethereum or any cryptocurrency that they don't see in the current financial system that appeals to them? Why would they switch to Bitcoin over just dollars and giving people their credit card number?
So I think it comes down to the fact that this network can process transactions conceivably, at a much lower cost than other systems, right? So when we use Visa, it's a 1% fee, it's a 2% fee. In an ideal world, these blockchain systems would process for pennies, right, or fractions of a penny. And so that's certainly one of the features that people are excited about. I think also the fact that they are seizure proof. So in certain parts of the world where you might be subject to capital controls or seizure or, theft, it prevents some of those things. And so those are the features. So, early on people were really focused on the privacy aspect. What we've come to find out now is that it's maybe not as anonymous as people would have thought. And so there are other assets that have optimized on privacy, like Monero and Zcash, that are, in fact, more private, I guess you would say, than Bitcoin.
So it sounds like governments would be naturally leery of cryptocurrencies. And I wonder about retailers. I mean, is really one of the major things that would create a tipping point for a cybercurrency being more accepted would be for a major retailer to accept it?
Yeah. So, it was actually just announced that Starbucks is going to be accepting it.
Oh, really?
And so, retailers actually love it. And the reason is because there's no fraud. So once a payment is sent, it cannot be sort of undone. So most retailers deal with or have to write off a certain percentage of credit card sales due to credit card fraud. And it depends who's liable for that between the credit card company and the retailer. but it definitely happens, right? Whereas every payment that's sent with Bitcoin, there is no, it can't be reversed. And so there's essentially 0% fraud in the sense that the retailer is taking no risk that once they've received that payment, they have it. And so if you talk with retailers like Overstock has been accepting Bitcoin for a long time, this is the point that they allude to, which is that, in fact, relative to credit card payments, it's a much more secure system. They vastly prefer it, actually.
Huh. Okay. So, but then when I've seen the presence of Bitcoin ATMs, what do they dispense if this is a virtual currency?
So Bitcoin ATM would allow you, you could think of the Bitcoin as being sort of a parallel financial system. And so you need on and off ramps, which is to say, I have dollars and I want Bitcoin. How am I going to convert those? Right? So either I could go to an exchange like Coinbase and, you know, deposit money into my account and then buy Bitcoin. But the ATMs are essentially serving the same purpose, right? I could go to an ATM, deposit $100, and then convert that to Bitcoin and, you know, send it to a digital wallet that I own. And so you could really just think of the ATMs as on and off ramps between fiat currency and digital currencies.
I only have a minute or two left here, and I do want to get into security tokens because the whole idea of cyber assets goes way beyond just currency. Can you give us a brief explanation of security tokens?
Sure. So one of the areas that I spend most of my time thinking about is the idea that we can take traditional assets, so stocks, bonds, real estate, that type of thing, and represent the ownership claims with tokens. And, you know, there's a variety of potential benefits of doing so. One of the reasons is that you can program logic directly into the security. So I won't go through, you know, a long explanation, but the basic idea is that you take any traditional asset that we have now, and instead of, you know, recording that ownership on paper and keeping it in a file cabinet, you record it with tokens. And what it makes it much easier to do is to buy and sell those fractional interests. So real estate or, you know, a venture capital fund, or there's lots of assets that are traditionally relatively illiquid, meaning it's very difficult and costly to trade those ownership claims. And security tokens potentially relieve some of those frictions.
Wow. So the idea, basically, we could move pretty much all of our assets into cyberspace, at least in how we access them. Stephen McKeon is an expert on cryptocurrencies, blockchain, Bitcoin, finance professor at the University of Oregon, studying crypto assets, security issuance, private equity, and mergers and acquisitions. We've learned a lot. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.